This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, good to see you back.
Holy smokes, where have we
been?
It's been
a couple weeks. Yeah. I don't know. I guess those holidays.
Vacation, that's right.
That's exactly right. You do take a lot of vacation.
Yeah, I do.
Well, it appears to me that you must have picked this week's topic.
Well, in a way, Tom, this topic chose me. You might know this, that women sometimes like to get together and chat about things in their life. And
constantly.
Yeah, I have a friend who, and this is true, this isn't me, this is a friend who was a patient at the Women's Health Clinic, and she told me that this was a topic that we had to cover. So, of course, I listened to everyone.
Sexual
and here
health
we are.
And sexual,
sexual
dysfunction.
Health, that's right.
Well, I have to tell you that I'm sort of glad you did, because I think most men are naive and in the dark about this topic. And I, first of all, didn't realize that this is a major issue and this is a topic.
It impacts men greatly.
Well, we've noticed that. It's a popular topic of discussion among women. And second, I don't think I realized or had any idea that the statistics show that over 40% of women suffer from some form of sexual dysfunction.
I think it has to be way higher than that.
Well, I don't even know what the term means,
okay,
really.
Well, we'll find
other
out.
Than the fact that lack of desire, if
okay.
That's a sexual dysfunction. And third, I was not aware that there is actually a website devoted to the study of women's sexual health. It's an organization's website, and the organization is called the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. What I did notice is that most of their meetings are in San Diego, so there's a good reason to become a sexologist study women's health.
That's good. Well, joining us today is the director of the Women's Health Clinic here at Mayo Clinic, Dr. Stephanie Fabian, and the chair of education for the Women's Health Clinic, Dr. Jackie Thielen. We'll find out what the biggest misunderstanding is when it comes to women's sexual health. We'll also find out what it means. Because we got to start there, I suppose.
Exactly. So there are some misunderstandings, I suppose, among women and men, particularly
right.
men.
We'll also learn how the sexual response is different for men and women, and learn how aging and menopause affect a woman's sexual response. And if you're not thoroughly embarrassed after all of that, Tom, we're going to discuss why this is just so important to health, the stability of a relationship and a family.
I want you to know that I could be called away on an emergency.
I won't be surprised.
I have figured out a way that we can delay this conversation
okay.
for at least a couple of minutes.
Okay, just a
I
little
want
bit.
To talk to a colleague in Florida at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. You know, we're hearing more and more about individualized medicine and about so-called genomic testing. And the program for individualized medicine, there's one here at the Mayo Clinic, there's one in Jacksonville, and the one in Jacksonville recently got a pretty big jump start, and that was thanks to a $5 million donation from Cecilia and Dan Carmichael, who live in Amelia Island, Florida. I don't know if you've ever been to Amelia
Island. It's beautiful.
Island. Nice place.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the Carmichaels learned about Mayo Clinic's work in individualized medicine after Mrs. Carmichael, Cecilia, received treatment for breast cancer at Mayo's Florida campus. Joining us by telephone, Dr. Alexander Parker, who is Associate Director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Individualized Medicine in Jacksonville. Dr. Parker, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
So congratulations to you and your colleagues. That's a wonderful grant for you and your group of individualized medicine experts.
Yeah, well, thanks a bunch. And obviously, I need to take a second to really just underscore how grateful we are to Dan and Cecilia and their whole family for this really kind of generous gift that's supporting Mayo's commitment to really, you know, revitalizing and evolving healthcare through the Center for Individualized Medicine.
And when you say individualized medicine, explain that, because haven't we always been providing medical care to individuals?
Exactly. I mean, the concept of individualized medicine in general sort of centers on this notion of customizing healthcare to the individual needs of the individual patient. And as you put, our physicians have always strived to do that. It's right there in our mantra, the needs of the patient come first. Not the needs of patients, but the needs of the patient. That patient sitting in front of you is the most important person in the room. And when we go to the doctor, you know, we're looking for answers for questions. What's my risk of getting disease? what's causing my disease that I have, what's the best treatment for me, what are there going to be any side effects, what's my quality of life going to be. And we want the answers to these questions to be as individualized as possible. So what's different now, like you said, we've always, tried to do that. We've seen some really rapid advances in technology, particularly in genomics, which I think we'll talk briefly about. They're now allowing us to personalize medical care like we've never been able to do before. And that's really what the mission of this Center of Individualized Medicine is to bring these exciting new technologies to the clinic to provide the best care, the most individualized care to every patient.
So what is genome sequencing?
Well, okay, there's a kind of a long answer there, which I'm sure you don't want because you got to get on to other things. But we've known for a long time that DNA is the code of life. That's the blueprint in our cells that lets us do what we do. And we've had kind of a love-hate relationship with that. I mean, we discovered DNA back in the 50s, and we knew that the answers were in there, but we really couldn't. We had a very limited ability to explore the depths. We kind of had to go gene by gene, if you will. So just for frame of reference, your entire genome is comprised of about 3 billion base pairs. And that's the letters we always hear about, the A, T, G, and C. Well, there's 3 billion of those. And that's a number that's really hard to wrap your head around. So just as an example, I try to give this as a way to help people understand the size. If I had my whole genome sitting in front of me, all the letters, and I started reading it to you right now at a rate of about 5 letters per second, it would take me 20 years to finish, and that's if I didn't sleep, eat, or stop at all.
Wow.
So we're talking about a massive amount of information, and in there is the answers to all of the mysteries of life. Well, historically, we've only really been able to come at it by looking at bits and pieces, these individual genes. Genome sequencing is new technology that allows us to explore the entire genome, and if you'll let me just real quick give an example from my own personal research experience. I'm interested in why some kidney cancers are aggressive and some aren't.
Okay.
And I know some of the answers are in the DNA that exists in these tumors. So historically, and by historically I mean only, 5-10 years ago, my approach had to be, well, let's develop a hypothesis around a particular gene that might be causing this. Why is one kidney cancer more aggressive than another? So I'd design a study. I'd spend, a good amount of money to try to, interrogate that gene and see if, sure enough, there were mutations in that gene in aggressive cancers that weren't in the non-aggressive one. Well, that's a single gene approach. Now, because of these rapid advances in technology that are driving the price down to where I can spend less money now by sequencing the entire genome of that tumor. So now I can look at the gene that I was interested in, but I can look at things I didn't even know about, or I hadn't even, developed a hypothesis around. So our ability to explore the genome now is just, light years from where we were 5-10 years ago, and it's opening up massive doors in research. As researchers, we're terribly excited. We're over the moon. But what is probably most interesting to your listeners today is that the price has now dropped on genome sequencing to where it is viable and a reality that we can start driving this into the practice, start using this technology to actually guide patient care.
And so what are you going to do with the funds, the gift from the Carmichaels? What is your plan for that $5 million donation?
Right. So that's a great segue because, while we're very excited about the research opportunities, and yes, we're going to use some of their generous gift to continue to help fund our researchers who have exciting new ideas, particularly our young investigators who are trying to, get their program started. We really want to use these funds, as we talked about with the Carmichaels, to really accelerate this process of moving from promise to practice, because we've heard for years that the genome's been sequenced. Clinton announced it back in 2000, and we've been waiting for this revolution. Well, we're using the Carmichael funds to really help drive things into the clinic, and it's helped us establish our local individualized medicine clinic here, which is a virtual clinic comprised of physicians, scientists, bioethicists, bioinformatics, and genetic counselors who are working with our physicians here to bring these genomic technologies to the patient bedside. And the two areas where this is happening, this is a reality today, are in advanced cancers. These are individuals who have failed their standard of therapy and they're kind of out of options, or people with rare tumors where there is no standard of therapy. And we're sequencing their tumors to try to get some clue as to what might work, what might be the individual answer for these people, and pair up a drug that actually will target that pathway that's been mutated. The other area where we're moving in the IM clinic to, again, move from promise to practice, to talk about things that are actually happening, is a service line we call Diagnostic Odyssey. These are people that have a disease and a condition that's been very difficult to diagnose, but we know it's probably got a genetic component because it runs in the family. We are now seeing these people in the clinic performing genome sequencing to get answers to what's causing their disease. And then in the home run situations, not only are we finding causative mutations for these people, but we're actually finding things that we can intervene on. So the message here is that we really are using the Carmichael Fund to move from promise to practice, and that's going to mean things like hiring genetic counselors that will actually be seeing the patient, all the way to actually using the funds to help support testing for people whose insurance companies, in my humble opinion, haven't seen the light yet, that they really should be supporting this technology for their patients because it provides better care, more cost-effective care, and just overall more effective care. So well, we're actually using it to pay for the testing itself.
You know, the whole thing is fantastic. And thanks to the Carmichaels, you've got 5 million reasons to help make this whole thing work. Dr. Alexander Parker, yeah, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Take care.
All right, it's time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with the director of the Women's Health Clinic at Mayo Rochester, Dr. Stephanie Fabian, and the chair of education for the Women's Health Clinic, Dr. Jackie Thielen. Both are sexual health experts.
Plus, myth or matter of fact, sexual desire changes with menopause. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for Drs. Fabian and Thielen at 507-282-1234. You can leave a question at our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or tweet us at any time, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives, along with Tracy McRae, and our guests are both from the Women's Health Clinic at Mayo Rochester, Dr. Stephanie Fabian. Welcome, Stephanie. Good to have you.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's an honor to be here.
And Dr. Jackie Thielen. Jackie, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
So both of you, I know, work in the Women's Health Clinic. I did not realize that sexual health is a big part of your practice. Would you say that's true? I mean, is this a topic that comes up frequently when you're visiting with women in your clinic?
In fact, it's incredibly common, and even when women are coming in for menopausal complaints, sexual health concerns will come up in the course of the discussion. So even if it's not a sexual health consultation initially, it becomes one after we get going on our consultation. So many, many women have these concerns.
So, Dr. Thielen, is this something that if women have a particular concern about their sexual health or about sexual activity, you two are the go-to women, or does everybody in the Women's Health Clinic sort of deal with this problem?
Well, luckily, we have multiple providers, all of which address sexual functioning as well as menopausal. But, you know, to be honest, that's not the only areas of women's health that we provide information for as well.
Is it, do the men ever come in? Does the spouse ever come in and talk to you about their concerns about sexual health or their wife's sexual health, or is it always just you and the female?
Sometimes it's important to get the partner's input. Typically, however, we do start with the woman alone in the room so that she feels comfortable in the conversation. Sometimes if you have a second or third party there, it's a little bit more awkward.
Let's just say for Dr. Shives' sake, because I know that he's kind of thinking, really, is this show something that we should be having? When we're planning out shows, he went, I don't really know that we need to do this show. But let's just talk about how this is different for men as it is for women. Obviously, we can have the main reasons why this is different for men and women, but why in our brains, how is sex different for men than it is for women? Dr. Thielen?
I would have to start with the fact that men and women physiologically are different and their brains work differently, so their responses are different. Men tend to be a little bit more goal-oriented, performance-driven, and so hence orgasm becomes a very important piece, mm-hmm. where women tend to be more intimacy-based, and so they're more thinking about the emotional part of it, although they certainly like the physical piece. It's the emotional piece that allows them to feel approached.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about this to me is that, you know, men have to have an orgasm to reproduce.
Slow down, you can do it.
But women don't. You know, so there is truly a difference.
Yeah, so for women, it's not all about the orgasm. It really isn't. And we emphasize that frequently. And many women don't have orgasms when they have intercourse. In fact, the majority of women do not have orgasms with vagina sex.
Really?
So while it can be important and it's enjoyable, the goal for women is they want to feel closer to their partners. And that's what keeps them going back for more sexual activity.
Isn't that one of the big disconnects right there then? Because if for men, an orgasm is the key piece of what we're doing here, and for a woman it's not, that's right. Why a man can't understand. That's one of our first disconnects.
Exactly. Exactly. And frequently when a woman doesn't have an orgasm, the partner feels responsible for that and feels like they're somehow failing. But that's not so.
Now, one of the things that, you think men are in the dark about this whole thing, and basically I would say we're sort of naive about
because
it.
Because you're speaking for all men.
Well, I am.
Okay, no pressure.
Although, we never talk, so how would I know?
Just golf, that's all.
Exactly. So what are the biggest misunderstandings about sexual health for women? Things that we don't understand,
the
rest of us.
I would say that it's expected that desire decreases as you age. No, that's not necessarily true.
By person to person, that changes, or it's just that's just a myth.
It's a myth that's okay. Occurring. The other issue I think is with regards to orgasm is that what I wanted to make sure that we recognize is that women still do like orgasm. It's not a matter that it's not an important piece. Mm-hmm. It's just it's not necessarily an absolute needed component.
Gotcha. Because you brought up a myth, let's go to the myth or matter of fact that we talked about before the break. Sexual desire changes with menopause. Mm-hmm. And I just have always taken that as that's something that's part of the package with menopause. Mm-hmm. Is that a myth or is that a matter of fact?
Well, there are definite changes that occur with desire at the time of menopause. And what happens is a woman's hormones change drastically at the time of menopause. And so usually what we see is a woman will come in saying, I don't think about it anymore. I don't have any libido. I really couldn't care less. And sometimes that is related to a hormonal change, but sometimes it's related to other things that are going on in the relationship. So for women, it's not so simple as taking a Viagra pill. That's not most of the time going to be the answer, and in fact, almost never. Mm-hmm. But we have to go through all the other things, all the other components that affect a woman's sexuality to see if other things are involved. And that could be medical things that are going on, illnesses, medications. It could be something going on in the relationship. It could be substance abuse, it could be a history of sexual abuse, it could be how they were raised in terms of their sexuality and what their family of origin thought of sexuality.
Can we talk about the little cave woman piece of this? Because I asked you if this was true or not. A long time ago, I read an article about the little cave woman and the caveman. The caveman's job is to impregnate as many women as he can to get the population going and to carry his genes on. The cave woman's job is just to get pregnant and have children. So once
job done.
You have done. Okay, so I have done that. And so is biologically, I read that there's a switch that goes, okay, we're done with that part of your cave woman life now. And is that true? Is there really the physiological piece that I don't need to have sex now?
I think definitely there is an anthropological function for this decreased desire that we often see at midlife. However, let's emphasize that most women who had healthy sex lives before menopause can absolutely continue to have healthy sex lives after menopause, and in fact, until they die. And that's what we hope will happen. But we are fighting nature a little bit, I think, with the hormonal changes, wouldn't you say, Jackie?
Definitely. The other piece of it as we age is, well, there's other things in life that get in the way.
Sure.
We're exhausted, tired.
Well, if you've got little cave children running around.
Definitely.
So, for men, there really is not a drug out there for libido, to increase libido. I mean, do you ever see, do the women come in and say, I still have strong sexual feelings for my partner and I want to continue an intimate relationship, but my husband doesn't? Does that ever happen?
Well, men do have testosterone out there, and that is used for libido in some cases, and for, in some cases it shouldn't be used for that reason. But yes, women come in and often say, I still have a libido and my husband doesn't, and that does occur, and we have to get into the relationship pieces when that happens. And in fact, with every woman that comes in with sexual dysfunction, we have to explore all these areas.
Yeah, but you're suggesting that the hormonal changes as a woman ages have an effect on her libido. But the same should be true for a man, shouldn't it? I mean, testosterone decreases as you get older.
But men don't go through the drop off the cliff hormonally.
They go.
They have a gradual decrease in testosterone. And in fact, women have a gradual decrease in testosterone as they age, just as men do. But women do fall off a cliff with in terms of estrogen and progesterone at the time of menopause.
And if you replace estrogen and progesterone, does their sex drive increase in general?
Not necessarily.
Can't pin it down.
Not necessarily.
Everybody is looking for a drug to increase women's libido, right?
Right, yes. And in fact, there are many drugs in the pipeline that we might see coming down. But it's important to note that for most women, a drug is not going to be the answer.
Yeah, that was a question on our Facebook page. My sex drive went off a cliff. Where's Viagra for women? And both of you said, that's not the answer.
No.
I was surprised to hear that.
It's not going to be the answer.
Yeah, but Viagra isn't a sex drive drug. I mean, all that does is treat erectile dysfunction. It doesn't have anything to do with desire, right?
Very true. And that's a misconception, even among men, that they think, gosh, I don't care, but this drug is going to help me care. And that's not the case.
Well, we've got lots more to talk about, that's for sure. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guests are from the Women's Health Clinic at Mayo Rochester, Dr. Stephanie Fabian and Dr. Jackie Thielen. Coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams.
And right after that, we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234. Comments and questions from our website, too, radio.mayoclinic.org. And your tweets at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is the Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Every year, thousands of people have stents placed in their coronary arteries to open up blocked arteries and restore blood flow to the heart. Stents work well, but they're not without risk. There can be side effects, including damage to the inner lining of the arteries. Now, this can cause re-narrowing of the artery. Drug-coated stents are designed to stop that, but they pose another risk, the possibility of blood clots forming inside the stented artery. Now, in animal models, researchers who published a paper in the American Heart Association journal Arteriosclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology found that a compound called CTP synthase inhibitor may help the blood clot issue. They say someday this compound may provide a long-term fix by supporting the repair of the injured artery lining. And here's some more heart health news. Mayo Clinic researchers have found a way to resynchronize cardiac motion following a heart attack using stem cells. Scientists implanted engineered stem cells into mouse hearts following a heart attack. This regenerative approach successfully targeted the origin of abnormal cardiac motion, preventing heart failure. Now, current therapy uses devices such as pacemakers, but many patients with advanced heart failure do not respond favorably because heart tissue must be healthy for optimal outcome. Stem cell-based repair would offer a new solution for some patients. Here's Dr. Andre Terzic.
So introducing a stem cell-based therapy allow us to rebuild the damaged heart and ensure ultimately resynchronization. While this study is a so-called proof of concept study, in other words, was done in experimental models, the new knowledge that we have obtained from this study provides a firm foundation to proceed into expanding these studies, validating them, and ultimately one day bring them all the way to patients.
And this was published in the Journal of Physiology. And now here's some info about how sleep affects your appetite. A study in the journal Obesity reports people who were deprived of one night's sleep bought more calories and more food in a pretend supermarket on the following day. Sleep deprivation also led to increased blood levels of a hormone that increases hunger. But there was no correlation between those hormone levels and food purchasing, suggesting that other issues such as impulsive decision-making may be culprits. Researchers say they think sleep deprivation leaves people hungrier and less capable of making
making good choices and employing self-control, and it increases impulsive decisions when it comes to foods. They say their findings suggest people concerned about caloric intake keep a healthy, normal sleep schedule. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Information you want from specialists who know, on air, online. And don't forget, you can all get us anywhere on iHeartRadio. You know, it's time for the listeners to take over. Tell them how they can get a hold of it.
That's right. You can call us at 507-282-1234. Go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, to leave a question. Or you can tweet us at any time at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. And we should add that this program does contain some candid discussion that might make some people uncomfortable. We just want to remind you of that if you haven't already figured that out.
You didn't tell me I could leave.
Yeah, no, you can't leave. You have to stay here. We do have some myth or matter of fact that we need to get to, though. Let's start with remaining sexually active helps maintain sexual function. So use it or lose it, myth or matter of fact.
That is a matter of fact.
It is.
So as women age, there are definite hormonal and physiologic changes that occur. It takes a little longer to become fully aroused and to become lubricated. Clitoral stimulation is very important. But for women who do remain sexually active, it makes it easier to maintain that sexual activity over time. So that's incredibly important. We also need to talk about vaginal dryness. Vaginal dryness is extremely common in women after menopause, and it occurs because they lose estrogen around that menopausal time frame. But this is easily managed, initially with over-the-counter lubricants. And if those don't work well, we have all kinds of vaginal estrogen products that help maintain the health of the vagina and can help women remain sexually active throughout their entire lives.
If a woman asks you about lubricants, you know, there are, how many of those out there? What do you tell them? I mean, do you have a recommendation? There are different kinds, different types.
Well, Tom, you'll be interested to know that not all lubricants are sold at the regular grocery stores or pharmacies.
Okay.
Many lubricants that are used for sexual activity are actually sold online or at adult stores that actually may work at times better than the ones sometimes that you can use over the counter.
The his and hers that I can buy at the pharmacy, no?
I would sort of say that good marketing, not so good in use.
Okay, very good.
For many women, some of the additives in those products can be actually a sense of burning or discomfort to the vulvar area. So we tend to tell our patients to stay away from those.
Okay, you mentioned clitoral stimulation. And if you have a women's sexual health clinic, I just have to ask, the main joke, I would suppose, that men come in with is, I just can't find the clitoris. Where is it? Can you help me? Isn't that what this clinic is for?
You're going to be surprised to know that some women don't know where their clitoris is either.
Okay.
And
why is it important?
I think it's important to recognize that sexual education sometimes is just inadequate when people are younger. And, well, people just don't talk about it. If you have come from a family where sex isn't talked about, you may not learn those specific details. But when it comes to sexual functioning, the clitoris is essentially the erectile tissue, much analogous to the male penis, and that requires stimulation in order for orgasm to occur.
And wouldn't sexual, health that kids get at school or that you talk about at home would have to do more with the procreation side of sexual health and not the enjoyment side of sexual health?
Absolutely. And we really advocate for women and encourage them to take responsibility for their sexual health. And so if they don't know where their clitoris is, how will their partner ever figure out how to make sure that they experience pleasure? So they need to figure it out on their own first.
And remember, if you are brave, or even if you're not, if you're just curious, give us a call at 507-282-1234, or you can tweet your questions to Audrey, our producer, at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. I've learned something, heard a word that I'd never heard before, so I got to ask this question. Myth or matter of fact, dyspareunia is better than no perunia at all. I know that's a Tom Shives question, but first of all, I don't
you
know.
You asked me to come up with some myth or matter of fact.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. What is dyspareunia?
Dyspareunia is pain with sex, and it can be related to a lot of different things. But I guess to the point, this is definitely a myth. So women having painful sex is better than no sex at all. That is not true. So if it's painful, you shouldn't be having sex, and you should seek help for whatever is causing the pain.
This has to be a part where men go painful sex?
It's incredibly common.
How can that be possible?
It's at least 40% of women at some point in their lives have experienced some pain with sex.
Postmenopausal is because of vaginal dryness would be probably the most common cause. But what are some other causes that you can help with?
You'd be surprised where young women, especially with the initiation of sexual activity, may recognize that they have pain. And it's often related to muscular tension in the muscles. And there's a term actually called vaginismus, which is an involuntary contraction of muscles with penetration.
And if, as a young woman, that is how you know sex, how it is introduced to you, then there's no way for you to know that pain is not part of sex.
Correct.
Right. And that's a very important message, to say pain with sex is not okay. And it's not something you should put up with.
The other thing we find is pelvic pain. And that can also present as dyspareunia as well. And the pelvic floor is a group of muscles that can be aggravated for various situations, surgery, as well as other activities that can aggravate and result in pain.
Do you ever see an instance where a painful intercourse, you discover something that's seriously wrong? Like, there is cancer of the vagina, isn't there, or the female genitalia someplace? Does that ever come up?
Of course, there are other causes for pain, but what we mainly see, it's very rare to see a cancer as a cause of pain. Most of the time, what we see, it's either thinning and atrophy, meaning thinning of the vagina, that's causing pain. Some women have overactive nerves around the vagina. We call that vestibulitis, and that can be a cause of pain as well. And frequently that comes along with atrophy or thinning of the vaginal area with menopause. But also the pelvic floor muscles spasming and contracting can be a cause. So frequently there are several things contributing.
One of the things I've been surprised to learn is, as we were sending emails back and forth this week, I thought the main thing that you would suggest to a woman when she's finally brave enough to come and see you is medication, because we are just a take a pill kind of society. And I really thought that would be the first thing. And Dr. Thielen, you said, no, that's down. That's down at the bottom of the list. We need to talk about self-care. So explain to me what you mean about self-care.
Well, I would have to say that one of the most common reasons why women don't have the energy for sex is fatigue.
Sure.
We're just burning the candle on both ends these days. And so, yeah, we're just plain old tired. Mm-hmm. And our body just rather not have sex, but we've got all these other things that we have to do. So if she's taking care of her physical needs, getting enough rest, eating, spending time relaxing, it definitely helps with her energy level.
Sure.
And she's going to be more apt to have some spontaneous sexual thought as well as engage in activity.
So exercise gets your body moving, and it keeps your body moving.
We definitely know that people who exercise on a regular basis tend to have better libidos.
Hmm. Is that right?
Correct.
So, I mean, you know, basically we talk about the same things every week. Exercise, diet, don't smoke. I mean, you know,
right.
A healthy lifestyle is good for so many things.
What else do you want women to know? Oh, let's talk about the website that you had shared.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to bring up the ISWISH website, and that's the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. And the website is isswsh.org. And there is a WISH statement, Women's Initiative on Sexual Health, a position statement on increasing and encouraging development of drugs in the pipeline, and not just drugs, but other psychosocial treatments, but all treatments for sexual dysfunction in women. And it's just acknowledging that this is a really big, relevant problem for women all across the United States, and that we need to encourage development of more treatments. So if you'd like to support that statement, you will find it on the ISWISH website.
Right, and you can find that at radio.mayoclinic.org. I put a link up to that statement there, too. Myth or matter of fact, older adults aren't usually sexually active. Dr. Thielen, or who's going to go?
I think I'll take that one.
Okay.
Older adults, yeah, definitely are sexually active. That is a myth if you're thinking that it falls off at a certain age and you can't be active. It may look different. The activities may be different, but it's intimacy nonetheless.
When a woman comes into your clinic and says, just like this one says, the tweet, my sex drive has driven off a cliff, are you still looking for a prescription answer to this? Aren't a lot of drug companies working on a libido drug? I mean, is there something in the pipeline that you're excited about or looking forward to having available?
You know, I think there are several drugs in the pipeline that are not close to being available. They will take several years. However, I think it's unrealistic to expect any drug to be the answer for women. So for women who come into our clinic, we explore all areas of their health and their relationship and their stress level and everything that's going on in their lives to help figure out what's going on and why their sex drive isn't what they feel it should be. And sometimes it's really a matter of reassuring women that they're in fact normal.
So they're sort of frustrated.
They are frustrated, but many women have this idea that, you know, the media portrays women as being quote-unquote cougars as they get older and that they should be that way and that somehow they're failing if they're not that way. And so sometimes what we do is simply reassure women that they're okay and they're normal.
Wow, interesting. And sometimes, I suspect not infrequently, it has to do with the relationship itself more than anything else.
Absolutely. That can't be stressed enough. It's critically important that the relationship is intact and healthy. And if it isn't, then why would you want to have sex?
You had mentioned the dyspareunia part, the pain part, and the friend that suggested this program, that's the reason why she ended up in your clinic, was because of something that I'd never heard of before. The thinning of her vaginal wall is what was causing her pain. She never had pain. How does that work? Is that just an aging process?
That's a process that's related to estrogen. Your vaginal mucosa likes estrogen, and it maintains its thickness as well as the integrity of those cells. They maintain their plump factor.
Mm-hmm.
And when that estrogen level is down, they sort of, I don't want to say shrivel because it doesn't sound like a very nice term, but it decreases in size and they lose their ability to lubricate as well as their elastic qualities. And I think we all focus on lubrication, but it's the elastic piece also that maintains your comfort with sexual activity.
So in that instance, the use it or lose it doesn't really apply. That's just something that's happening with time. Go ahead.
Well, sexual activity definitely helps.
Okay.
And there are women who go through the menopausal transition and remain sexually active and never need anything else.
Okay.
But most certainly, the majority of women will benefit from some vaginal estrogen being added back in, along with a lubricant.
Because in general, hormone replacement therapy has gotten a bit of a bad name. When you talk about giving estrogen for vaginal dryness, you're talking about giving it locally, and then so not much of it gets into the system.
That's a great thing to bring up, and that's a whole other topic that we could get into about hormone therapy being given a bad name, because we are really coming full circle on that picture to where hormone therapy isn't nearly as bad as we thought. However, your point was that not much of it is absorbed when it's given vaginally, and that's absolutely true. Those tissues are so dry, and they soak it up like a sponge in the first couple of weeks, but after that, almost nothing is absorbed, and the levels remain in the postmenopausal range. So women don't need to worry about any long-term health effects related to that, no breast cancer risk, et cetera.
People soured on hormone replacement therapy because of its negative effects on the heart. Is that correct?
That's a whole other show. But the effects on the heart are actually beneficial for women in their 50s on estrogen only. And so we're coming back full circle on that.
I'm sorry, Jackie, go ahead.
I actually sort of forgot what I was about to say, but I think it's important that we recognize that vaginal estrogen is, yes, a important part of this whole thing, but lubricants can also be helpful. And
absolutely.
Sometimes we don't necessarily have to go to estrogen if the lubricants themselves are helpful.
And there are over-the-counter moisturizers as well, which are different from lubricants in that they can be used on a regular basis to help maintain moisture, and they can be helpful for many women.
So when a woman comes to the Women's Health Clinic and she says, well, there might be a sexual piece of why I'm here, which is really then the real reason why she came in. What is the first thing? I mean, does she talk to a counselor, a psychiatrist type of a person? Like, let's just work on your head first, or is it let's find out if there's a physical reason why you're not interested? What is the how does the course go when a patient comes to see you?
The first step is to have a visit with a physician, and we typically review the physiological part, yes, the how the body works and how that's going, but also the psychological pieces and the relationship. What I tell people is we look at all the various possibilities that could have an impact, and the bottom line is to try to optimize those pieces. There, again, isn't a magic cure and magic cream or anything like that. We just try to optimize the pieces that are identified as a source of problems.
So is it an easy fix? I mean, is this just, it would seem to me that if the part of the component isn't just that you give a pill and then, okay, we're better. If the thing is you have to teach someone how to communicate what they want, show them what works with their body. You know, it sounds like it would be a big involved process.
It is. And so it usually does take a family. Or community, mm-hmm. And so we also have providers, psychological providers, even dermatologists that are interested in specific vaginal concerns. It depends on the patient, and typically we work throughout the subspecialties to get her answer.
It's a team approach.
I sent a blog post that many women had sent on Facebook today through this week, and it was all about a woman who was my age, basically, who had gone through infertility treatment. They had two kids. She just can't take it anymore because sex became a chore to get pregnant, and now she just says, you know, I'm in my mid-40s and I'm out. I'm done with this. It made me so sad, and I thought, I hope that this woman, I sent her a message and said, actually, call in, be part of the show. And you said that sometimes when people go through infertility treatments, that can have some negative consequences in regards to what we're talking about.
It absolutely does. When you go through infertility treatments, it becomes such a laborious process, and sex does become a job. It's on a time schedule. It's not so much for pleasure. It's really for the goal of procreating. And so then pleasure drops out of the picture. And so it's sometimes hard for women to re-engage, and couples, it's not just women, re-engage in sexual activity for pleasure in and of itself. And sometimes they need a little help and support getting back there.
So what, we've come to the end of our time. So tell
That's
us,
shocking.
I know, what can we do? But we still had a good time. Sorry, I couldn't help. Can you tell us what women can do to help maintain sexual health?
I think it's important to take care of yourself, cultivate a relationship with your spouse, take time for yourself, and communicate your needs.
And Dr. Fabian?
And come see us in the Women's Health Clinic if you need any help.
All right, Dr. Stephanie Fabian, Dr. Jackie Thielen, thanks so much for being with us.
It was a delight. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with multiple sclerosis expert Dr. Orhun Kantarsi. You know, out of the blue and for no apparent reason, this is a disease that can strike virtually anyone, but frequently it's people in the prime of their life, both men and women. Well, what is MS? We'll ask Dr. Kantarsi, and why do they call it an autoimmune disease? Do you recall what that means?
It affects the body, attacks its own immune system.
Exactly. Yeah, you have learned so much.
I have. I have a friend, her son is a college kid, just was diagnosed with this. And so it seems that are more people being diagnosed, or am I just becoming more aware of it? And is there a genetic component? Everything is all about genetics, as we heard at the beginning of the show, and I want to know more about that, too.
That's absolutely true, and we'll ask Dr. Kantarsi when we visit with him next week, and we'll also talk about the symptoms. They're many and varied. That's why this is a condition that can be difficult to diagnose in its early stages.
And how do you live with it once you have been diagnosed?
Exactly. We'll talk about treatment. You know, there's some new drugs out there, and there are some in the pipeline, all about multiple sclerosis. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, please visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can get a podcast of today's program and past programs, and leave suggestions for future topics, or visit us at mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers will share their expertise to help you.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Kim David. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.